Morning again. I thank you for the opportunity to stand before you. I can tell you I'm humbled by the opportunity, by the responsibility that I have to preach the truth. I hope that I can fulfill that. And I say to you that come back next week, Andy will be back and he'll do a much better job. I have several interests. There are a number of things that capture my imagination, that keep me intrigued, that keep me occupied from time to time. You could say I have a whole lot of hobbies. And I imagine I'm not alone in that. And since I have far more interests than I have time to spend on any of them, they kind of come and go. Kind of one thing will be on my mind, I'll be looking into that, I'll be learning more about it, studying about it, paying attention to it, and then it'll kind of fade and something else will come up. So I kind of skip around and do a lot of different things. One of the things that's been on my mind a little bit recently is just the study of history in general. Now, that probably makes me pretty peculiar that I find history interesting, but it probably has to do with because I love a good story, and history's full of good stories, and so I've always been fascinated by history. Had some good history teachers in high school that really brought that out and encouraged me in that regard. So since I've been interested in that lately, and I was looking for a topic for this morning, I thought we might spend a little time talking about the history of the church and what we can learn from that and how we can benefit from that study. Now, you probably remember hearing, if you didn't ask the question yourself back when you were required to study history, why do we have to learn this? What effect does this have on my life? How is this going to change anything? Knowing that this happened on this date isn't going to help me in the future. So anytime you look at history, I think it's worthwhile to spend a little bit of time talking about why. Why study history? And when you apply that to church history, I think you have to start at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16, where Paul tells Timothy that all Scripture is good for reproof, for doctrine, for correction, for instruction. And since all Scripture includes significant portions that are dedicated to history, you could look at the Old Testament as predominantly a history of the Israelite people. The book of Acts that we're studying in our Sunday morning class is the history of the early church. Since all Scripture is good for study, and that includes significant portions dedicated to history, then you can draw the conclusion that Paul is telling Timothy that history is worth studying, especially the history related to us in Scripture. So we have that. We also have practical reasons to study history. We've all heard the saying that those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. A friend of mine likes to say it this way: only a fool learns from his own mistakes, a wise man learns from the mistakes of others. And the way I take that is I certainly don't have time to make all the mistakes myself. So if I can see where somebody else made a mistake, then I might be able to learn from it and not have to make that one, because there are plenty that I've got in front of me to make anyway. So some practical reasons and some scriptural reasons to look at history. A couple of things I want to touch on before we get too deep, and I hope this doesn't go too deep anyway. I have a tendency to ramble, so somebody wave your hand if I get too far gone. When you look at history, there's something you've got to be careful of, and this is something that I call the arrogance of modernism. And that's a term that I came up with. I don't know if anybody else would recognize that. But what I mean by that is that when you look at history, when you look at the past, it's easy to think that we today are so far advanced from things that happened before that we could never suffer those consequences because we know so much more, we understand so much more about the world around us and the way things work, that the things that they went through were because they were not as well educated, maybe even not as intelligent. And this is something that it's very subtle. And it's just kind of underlying that when we look back at the past, we think, well, you know, I can't believe they thought this or they thought that. And they believed that and did things based on that belief. But I think if you went back to any point in history and you talked to those individuals, they would feel the exact same way about things that have gone before them. And if you went forward, if you could, and asked somebody 100 years from now to look back on us today, they would have the same arrogance of modernism, that the now is we're so much better and so far advanced from the way things were before. And the reason that's a problem is because you fall into the trap of thinking that I can't be susceptible to the consequences that they suffered because I know so much more and understand so much better. So we need to be careful about that and not fall into that trap. The second point I want to touch on before we get into our discussion of history of the church is there's one fact that will frame any history of the church, and that is the fact that the church has always been and will be at war with Satan. From the very beginning, back in Genesis, when God prophesied that he would send his son, when he told the serpent that the seed of woman would bruise his head, from that point, if you look at that as a declaration of war, from that point forward, this organization, this body called the church, when all through the Old Testament, when it's predicted as being at war. From the time it's established, Jesus, and I'm getting ahead of myself and I'm using some of my points, so I'll refer back to this later. When Jesus is talking to Peter, and he tells him that on this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, he's reiterating this declaration of war. And as we look at the history of the church, the first century and beyond, the traditions that we can look at, the history that we have of the time after scriptural time, the church has always been and will be at war. And that's important because everything you learn about the church is colored by that fact. So now, let's look at the history of the church. And we start in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. Because we have the advantage with the church of starting even before the beginning. In verse 44, Daniel here is interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. We have the church predicted in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. Now, why bring this out? Well, there's an important point here because there are some who say that the church is a spontaneous reaction to the rejection of Jesus by the Jews. And in this line of thinking, the statement is made that if Jesus had not been rejected by the Jews, that he would have set up a physical kingdom and that he would have reigned over it for a time and so on and so forth, and they go on and on. What this tells us, though, is that the original plan was a kingdom that consumed all other kingdoms that would stand forever, and we know it to be a spiritual kingdom. The church was the plan. It wasn't plan B. It wasn't a spontaneous reaction to the rejection of Jesus. It was the plan. It is a predicted body from the beginning, from on back into Genesis, and here we have the specifics in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. Let's go to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. This, as I referred to earlier, this is Jesus and Peter discussing his confession. I get to write Matthew 16, 18. Yes. Jesus has asked Peter who people say that he is. Peter has responded in verse 16. Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." The church predicted and the declaration of war reiterated. We go to Acts chapter 2 and we see the church established. We see the beginning of the church. We see Peter and the other apostles standing before men preaching that the Jesus that they crucified was the Christ that they had been looking for. And we see on that day 3,000 added to the church. We see the church beginning there. Now we said the church has always been at war. Go to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12. I'm going to jump around a little. Ephesians 6:12, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." We are at war, not with physical people, not with physical beings, but with Satan, with spiritual entities, with dark powers. We're at war with Satan. And one of the benefits of a study of church history is that we can see how Satan has fought against the church. And by learning that, we can learn how to defend ourselves against that today. Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. This I'm going to call Satan's initial strategy in fighting against the church. "Now Saul was consenting to his death," referring to Stephen. "At that time a great persecution arose against the church which was at Jerusalem." Satan's initial strategy in fighting against the church was that of violent persecution. We see the church persecuted. Now this might be our initial reaction to anything we call war. We assume violence is going to be associated with it. And this is what Satan tried. And I don't want to in any way leave the impression that he doesn't continue this effort even today. We mentioned in class there are still places where Christianity is illegal. There are places where Christianity is not necessarily illegal, but teaching and preaching is certainly punishable by death. Which raises the question, how is that not making Christianity illegal? Because can one be a Christian without preaching and teaching? There are places in the world today where it is very difficult physically to be a Christian. But toward the end of the first century, Satan's tactics seem to change in a broad, general sense. Again, not that he stops the persecution of the church. But he moves from a persecution of the church to a perversion of the church. And this should come as no surprise. There are many scriptures where this is predicted, this is prophesied. Jesus talked about it in Matthew chapter 7, look at verse 15. Chapter 24, verse 11. Paul refers to it in Acts chapter 20, verse 29. The wolves in sheep clothing that will not spare the flock. 2 Peter 2, 1. 1 Timothy 4, 1 through 3. All these are references to the prediction that Satan will change his tactic and will attempt to pervert the church from within. And this is where I want to spend the bulk of our time this morning. That's why I kind of move through the others rather quickly. Again, not that the persecution of the church ends, but Satan attempts, instead of violently persecuting the church in general, to perverting it from within. Let's finish Acts 8:1. "And they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles." And let's go to verse 4. "Therefore, those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word." And this is why I think Satan changed his tactic, because the violent persecution against the church didn't serve his ends. It didn't work for him. What happened when he persecuted the church in Jerusalem? People went everywhere spreading the gospel, and the church grew and spread. And so he begins to try to pervert it from within. We talked about this when we discussed the organization of the church in class. We talked about the fact that over time, slowly, gradually, the plan for the church, the organization of the church, was left behind. If we picture this as an illustration, let's picture a straight line being God's plan for the church. This is how the church is supposed to be organized. This is how the church is supposed to act. This is how things are supposed to work. This is God's straight line, His plan. And in the first century, throughout most of it, we see that that was held pretty close to. But toward the end of it, one elder becomes preeminent over the others. And we see the bend a little bit. And then that one elder becomes preeminent not just over one congregation, but over many congregations. And we see it drift a little bit more away from the straight line. And we see this drift continue. At the same time, looking at history, the church is being more and more accepted. Things are changing in the world because these people have gone out and spread the gospel, and the gospel has affected people. And by 300, the year 306 or so, the emperor of Rome considers himself a Christian, and it becomes something of a state religion, and therefore the persecution that Rome perpetrated against the church, that violence where Christians were killed as entertainment, ends. And the church becomes more and more accepted as it drifts further from God's plan. And this process continues. And this is, of course, centric to Western history. This is the history that we identify with. It is certainly likely that, as we referenced this morning, the Ethiopian eunuch, when he returned to Ethiopia, that he spread the gospel. And indications are that the true church, the Church of Christ, has been consistent pretty much in sections of Ethiopia since that time. But we're speaking, as I said, of Western history, and that refers to mostly European history and so on and so forth, and we won't get into those kinds of details. But we understand that over time, there was a gradual departure from God's plan. And we see Satan perverting the church and turning it away from the original plan of God. This continues all the way up till 1517, when a man named Martin Luther nails 95 theses to a door of a church in Germany. And he does this in reaction because he's so repulsed by how far the church has gotten from God's plan. One of the major things that Martin Luther objected to was the practice that they had of accepting money. You see, over time there had become this doctrine of purgatory, that when someone died, instead of going straight to judgment, that they went to a holding place and they could, if they were saved, they could serve time in purgatory. And then when that time was served for their sins on this earth, that they could be released from purgatory to their reward of heaven. And it had gotten so corrupt and so far from God's plan that the priests were accepting money from rich families to absolve their deceased family members from years in purgatory. In other words, let's say I'm a rich person in the 13th century, 14th century, and I have a relative die. I can go to the priest and say, my relative died. He was not right with God. He's probably going to have a long time in purgatory. How much to get him out? And I could write the priest a check, and he would tell me, well, you've taken care of his time in purgatory, he'll go straight to heaven. And this has absolutely nothing to do with anything in Scripture. This has no basis anywhere in God's plan. But this is how corrupt and how far away from God's plan things had gotten when Martin Luther is so repulsed by how far things have gotten that he nails his thesis to the door and attempts to reform the church. And out of this effort come what we know as Protestant churches. But Satan never gives up. Even though this great span of time he's been able to pervert the church, at least in Western history, when Martin Luther decides to do something about it, he swings that pendulum to the opposite end of the spectrum and goes from a salvation that was being discussed that had absolutely nothing to do with faith, that was completely works-based, and had even gone beyond that where you could buy works for money. He moves to the other end and says, works have nothing to do with it. It's faith only. And he teaches and preaches a salvation that seems to completely ignore the entire book of James, where we're told that faith without works is dead, and so on and so forth. And so we see the Protestant movement, the Reformation, the reforming of the church. And we see Satan pervert that and again. And this continues all the way up until the 1860s or so, where in this country and in others, men who were among these denominations studied and read and learned that what they were preaching and teaching really wasn't God's plan either. We've seen this gradual departure. We see Martin Luther try and he misses the mark. And that continues to deviate as they denominate, as they divide and establish denominations. Satan has continued to pervert the church. These men, through their study, determined that they're not on the line either, and they want to get back there. And they restore the Church of Christ, which is where most of us could trace our lineage back to today. Now, I said that we wanted to focus on why we study history. And what I've given is just kind of a thumbnail sketch, and there's an awful lot of details that I've left out that we could go back and talk about that I might find fascinating, but I would probably be the only one. So I won't bore you with them this morning. I want to dig out two things that we need to be aware of, two things that we want to draw out as application. These are reactions to Satan's strategies against us. His two strategies, basically, that we're looking at this morning. He's persecuted and he's perverted the church. So how can we look back and learn from these things how we should react? When persecuted, Acts 8:4, therefore those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. When you're under duress, when you're under persecution, and not to equate the persecution that the first century Christians went through, being fed to lions, being thrown to wild animals for entertainment, but intellectually persecuted. When people laugh and say, how could you possibly believe that? You must not be very smart. And all the comments that we might hear today, what's the reaction to that persecution, that duress? Spread out and teach. Maintain the focus that we need to have. Go everywhere preaching the word. Number two, his second strategy against us, to pervert the church. Go back to Ephesians chapter 6 and look at verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. The times when we're accepted, the times when things are relatively easy. And if you don't think we're in one of those times, then we do need to go back and look more at the history of the persecution of the church. That's the time to be most vigilant. To study, to know what God's plan is. So that when these other ideas come up, whether subtly from within or strongly from without, that we can stand firm knowing what God's plan is. That we can stay on this line that defines God's plan. We need to heed the warnings given in the New Testament, all those scriptures that I listed earlier, and if you'd like that list, I'll get it to you, where we're warned against the false teachers from within and from without, the wolves in sheep's clothing. We need to emulate the Bereans as they're described in Acts 17, especially verse 11, where they were more noble than those in Thessalonica. Why were they more noble? Because they studied and they proved out the things they heard. That's how we need to react to acceptance, to things going well, to things being easy. We need to be vigilant. We need to stand. We don't need to lose our focus on reaching out to those who are lost. We don't need to get complacent and sit still and take it easy and not worry. That's the time to be vigilant and to stand. We said the church is at war. And it will be at war until the enemy is destroyed. But the advantage we have in the church is that we know how this history is going to play out. Even though it hasn't happened yet, we know how it ends. We know that the church wins the war. And that Satan will be defeated and put down in the end. And if you've not yet joined this winning team, you have this opportunity. And you can join the winning team and you can stand firm with us as we stand vigilant against the perversion of the church and against the persecution of the church. If you've been a part of the winning team and you're absent without leave, to use military terms, you can come back this morning and there's no punishment. If you'd like to come, we'll pray with you, pray for you. We'll return you to your rightful place on the winning team. If there's anything we can do for you, please come as we stand and sing.